You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Hi, and welcome to episode 10 of Red Setter, coming to you from the bunker at the Hitler complex. Actually, I'm just joking there, but I must have had about 20 people that sent me the YouTube video. And I'm joined here in the bunker, as always, by Jason. How are you, Jason?
Guten Tag.
Yeah. Not that we want to... don't mention the war. So there's a YouTube video flying around. Some of you may have seen. I know many of you did because you all emailed us about it, which is a very funny take on shooting on film and or Red. And if you haven't seen that, just YouTube. I'm sure everyone's probably seen it by now.
Yeah, I'll put a link into the show notes. It's basically a re-subtitled the scene from Downfall, I think, which has just been redubbed a million times for different purposes. And this time it's film and Red. It's very funny.
It is very funny. So look, stop sending it to us. We've got a really great Red Center lineup for you this week. We're going to do a few things this week. We've got a terrific interview that Jason did with a DIT, which is coming up in a minute. That's with
Ryan Kunkelman, who's just come off his second Red film.
And after that, we're going to have a bit of a discussion about lenses. It's going to get geeky and discuss what is it that makes a good lens. It's an interesting discussion we got into. Someone sent us an email about what do we think about lenses, and it led to me thinking, what is it that dictates what makes for a good lens or not? And so we tried to qualify that. Obviously, we have me geeking out as usual and Jason offering the voice of reason in terms of aesthetic appeal.
Sure.
And then after that, we have a really interesting Red Room interview, because we'd previously complained, Jason, that you'd only managed to find people with Australian accents, and you've actually gone and outdone yourself.
I've gone to Abu Dhabi this time to speak to Abdullah Mohammed Bastaki, who, if you do frequent Red User a bit, his little avatar does stand out. He's the only one wearing the full
traditional. Yeah, and that's great because we really costume. Do want to have people from all over the world, and I think it's brilliant to get someone from the Middle East. That's terrific.
No, so that's got a great story. So yeah, another one.
And more besides. So we're going to start up with the news, and this week. Well, I'm just back from shooting in Adelaide, actually. I've been shooting stop-frame animation down there, which has been huge, and doing stuff with the Red on motion control. And you've just come off a big shoot with a couple of Reds, haven't you?
Yep, a couple of days with babies, with a couple of cameras, which was quite good. It's quite interesting. I think by the time next episode rolls around, I would have finished, gone through the editing, gone through the post a bit more. And obviously, this is my second or third job on the Red, so there's been a lot of sort of water under the bridge, Red-wise and post-wise, so I think I'll do a little bit more in-depth next time around once we work out that what I think we've done is sort of cracked the post, Avid Post, a bit more. And so, yeah, I think it was
I'd like to discuss that as well because, I mean, clearly there are issues with Post, especially on an Avid workflow, and I, for one, don't pretend that they're all solved. A lot of them are solved with a scratch, but if you don't have a scratch, it is actually or can be quite confusing and quite painful and does no one in the industry a particularly good service. But there's some controversial stuff to discuss, but we're going to do that next week. This week we're going to start out with the news, and we have some interesting stuff, something particularly that I was piqued my interest, but I'll pass over to you at the news desk, Jase.
Okay. All right, well, the first one is the little ticker tape. The world debt counter has ticked over into the 2000s, so sort of creeping up on sort of halfway through all the deliveries, so starting to crank out cameras from 2000 and beyond, which is really nice if you're still waiting, which is a few people.
And what's the situation with lenses and stuff? Because I know I was contacted to get our 50 to 150 mil T3 lens, and we actually cancelled our order and or rather changed our order, I should say, to get the new 18 to 85.
Yeah.
Which isn't obviously out yet, but I don't know. You know, for me, I just love a wide-angle lens. But I think you're not that way inclined, are you?
I'm a bit more longer lens. Well, my sort of stuff, I suppose, is a bit more doco. I like to sort of back off a little bit and sort of not intrude on the act because I sort of do dialogue and all that sort of stuff. So I like to sort of back off on the on the lens and observe from a distance, I suppose.
So you have subtlety, whereas I have in-your-face, wide-angle, get it within an inch of the actor's face.
Well, it depends on what you're doing. I suppose it depends on what you want. I mean, these lenses, that you need wide-angle stuff for, you know, Steadicam and handheld and all that sort of stuff, and car rigs and interior of cars. I use wides all the time, but majority of my stuff is probably more on the tighter end, but it just depends on what sort of style of work you're doing.
Yeah, well, of course, we also, you know, rent lenses, so it's just getting a couple of good workhorses for us when we're not renting, and so we went for the 18-85. So what else is happening in the world of news and cool things?
Well, I'll go back to the gear and all that sort of stuff at the moment. Pretty much everything you would ever want for your Red is on back order.
Okay.
which good, because I suppose they're making it and they're getting it out there for people who have already got Reds or people who have pre-ordered stuff. But if you've decided, I think I'll get an extra whatever, you might just have to get the back of the queue for a little bit. Drives, EVFs, pretty much nearly all the lenses, except the one that you've already got, I think the 18-50 is available. You can get a Nikon mount if you want it. They're hanging around.
Did you see the stuff on the Canon mounts? It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's
there was an interesting discussion in Red User, or Red Crack, as we're prone to call it, about the fact that there are four mounts that are getting close to the level that Red would actually certify them as being cool. And it kind of got interesting because it came down to two of the mounts being the kind of preferred options for a full electric. I don't know if you saw this. Did you see this?
I saw a bit of it. I've been following a bit of the Berger or Berger mount for a little bit because people have just asked me to and sort of find out what's going on. And I really still can't quite answer that question.
Well, the Element Technica stuff is seems to be preferred, and the fact that they actually said that they kind of preferred it then caused outrage on Red User by somebody complaining that they were favouring Element Technica. But as the guys at Red said, the stuff from Element Technica just works, so it's not a matter of favouring them, it's just a matter of, you know, buying stuff that works, and certainly we've bought their stuff and think it's great.
Yeah, and whoever gets it out there as soon as possible is going to sort of, you know, benefit from all the people who've been waiting for the other mounts, I guess. I really still don't quite understand why it's taking so long. Why, if we can get Nikon mounts out pretty easy, why we can't get the Canons out? But let's not start that one.
It's not, but I can kind of understand where they're coming from, and obviously they don't want to wreck the new system for adjusting the back focus and stuff. So they're trying to get a mount that sits forward, which, you know, optically has some issues and electronically. But that isn't the big news that I was really keen about this week.
Right, I know what you're talking about. Okay, the mention of the new processor, or the new sensor, Monstro. Is that what you mean?
That is exactly what I mean,
right.
As you bump your microphone.
I do.
It's particularly interesting because, for me, it involves not only the fact that there's a new sensor, but it's an interesting roadmap as to what's happening with the new sensor. And I think that's you know, significant. And of course, we're talking about now something that's scheduled for 2010.
End
so this
2010.
Really, this really is not immediately about to come out.
So what do we know?
Well, we don't know a whole lot. We do know that Red has said that they haven't officially announced a whole lot of press stuff on it, but they have told me that the second that they do, they're going to let us know here at Red Center, which is very nice of them. Because they're nice people, and they like us doing our little podcast here, so they're very keen to get stuff to us. So what we know is mainly...
So the mothership listens.
The mothership does, and we like the mothership.
I'm so chuffed.
But, okay, so the Monstro will be a free upgrade to Epic, and of course the Epic's going to ship in 2009 with the Mysterium X.
Yep.
So if you remember what happened when Mysterium X was announced, there was initially, even from Red themselves, a little bit of toing and froing on whether that would be something that would go into the Red One. And then the answer came back, yes, no, absolutely, it's going to go into the Red One. And the question was, but why would you want it in the Red One? And this all centres around not the sensor, but around the backplane and the data rates that were coming through in the newer generation cameras. So just to repeat, we've got the sensor upgrade, but there's also an upgrade that happens with the sort of the guts of the machine that takes it from a 36 megabyte per second data limit up to about 100 megabytes a second. And this is something that's in the Epic, not in Red 1. So if you go up to 5K in a Red 1, you're going to be limited by that bandwidth off the sensor. Not the sensor itself, you understand, but where the sensor puts stuff and how fast it can be taken by something from the sensor. A problem solved, I might add, in Scarlett as well as in Epic.
So what does that mean?
It means that if you want to get high data rates in the terms of high frame rates, you're going to need an Epic back. And the thing about the Mysterium X is that it is, I guess, a version of the Mysterium Sensei, it's Mysterium X, as opposed to Monstro, which is a much, much more interestingly expanded high dynamic range type sensor. Now, question I've got is, why announce it now? Why announce Monstro now? It seems like a slightly odd time, not at IBC or NAB or anything.
Well, yeah. I mean, we know very little about the sensor in between, I guess, without having to, without the next one being launched. I don't know. Why not give us a bit more info? That'd be good.
I mean, the only thing I can think is that people are going to be making decisions right now as to whether or not to go for the Red 1 or to wait for their Epic. Now, yeah. It is possible, of course, to have a Red 1 and get 100% rebate on it when going for an Epic. But now knowing that not only with the Mysterium X chip is an option, but there'll be an upgrade to a more dramatically sort of improved dynamic range, low light capability chip, that means that there's probably, you know, it's not that that they're saying that the Red 1 won't take this. Mm. It's more to the point that will the Red 1 be able to take full advantage of this, and that's where I think Epic's going to be different. I don't think.
But why would they offer the sensor if the camera's not going to make use of it? I suppose.
Well, there's no reason why it would.
Size have... sensor, though, isn't it? It's a slightly different size. It's a full frame 35 versus super 35, isn't it?
Well, I don't know that.
Okay.
I don't know the dimensions on Monstro, but I'm really impressed that you do.
No, but if it's the same as what as Mysterium X. Is a bigger sensor than Mysterium, is it not?
Right, I see what you're saying. Well, I guess my point, though, is that if you've got an improved dynamic range, if it's able to capture more dynamic range, then it may not be a concern to you that you don't go to the higher frame rates. You just may want that.
Yeah,
so sure. So that makes sense. But I personally, you know, just crave shooting off. And it's funny, you know, I shot in China 120 frame a second Kung Fu stuff.
Yeah.
And certainly you get into some real issues there because we had to pump the ISO up to accommodate for the loss of light. It went to 120 frames. But
and you got to go to 2K.
And we got to do it to 2K. But I didn't mind going to the 2K so much. Just the thing that was interesting to me was, you know, actually 120 is actually quite fast. I mean, we were looking at stuff at 96 and people were going, is that 120? No, that's not even 120 yet.
Yeah, speeds are funny, aren't they?
It is actually a pretty remarkable difference. At 120 frames a second, Kung Fu turns into ballet. It's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, I saw some of the edit you're doing before. That does look pretty wild. So I'm just going to go back to the sensor thing for a minute. I know I don't want to get a bit of a sensor rat hole, but why not?
It's pretty important.
So, yeah, obviously, theoretically, if you're taking the... if you've got your Red 1 and end of 10, you can put Monstro in there. You may well make use of the dynamic range, any of the sort of visual... or the chip size, but not necessarily make use of the frame rates that it's going to let you do. The main advantage, I suppose, between Mysterium X or Monstro and the standard Mysterium is that you're probably going to be able to get higher frame rates without having to bump down to 3K or 2K to do it.
Okay, so let me just back up one second. This is this problem we have, right? It's not just a function of the chip, it's a function of where the chip bungs the data. So as a completely speculative comment, I'm going to say that the Mysterium could actually run much higher frame rates right now, except for the fact that it's got nowhere to put the data, you see. So my contention, when they first published the information on the Mysterium, I think that they had solved getting the chip to generate the images. I just don't think they can put them anywhere. Now they're solving the where to put them anywhere, but the putting them anywhere bit requires a camera change. The chip gives you high dynamic range, better low light capability, and resolution. So we don't know what resolution Monstro will be, but let's say it just stays at 5K for argument's sake. You know, you may want it to have that better dynamic range even at a 2K crop on the sensor. And that obviously would be valid inside the data handling capabilities of even the Red 1. So the data rate thing becomes an issue when you want high frame rates, high resolution, and you just can't deal with the data quick enough through the film back.
Yeah.
And so it really is a combination of sensor and camera, or sensor and stuff in the back of the camera. So, for example, you know, I can't get 4K 16 by 9, 25 frame a second to record to a CF card on the Red 1.
Yeah.
Not that the camera is not capable of doing it, it's just that it can't get it to the CF card.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is all related around this megabytes per second data rate that we're... So the reason to go to Epic is twofold. One, to go up to that 100, which also could happen if you went to the Scarlett, which is why it can do 160 frame burst. But the second thing is then, of course, you can open up to doing new sensors and improving effectively a whole bunch of stuff. And of course, you know, if you're down at Scarlett, you're no longer at a PL mount 35mm lens. Look,
we're talking end of 2010, which is like ancient, deep, deep, darkest future history in Red, which, I mean, if you look back on what they've achieved so far, I mean, who knows what drives you're going to be able to record to on a Red 1, even if you, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's true, but I think that it is significant if people are sitting around wondering whether or not they should be going for Red 1, sure, hanging off for Epic.
Of course.
I can actually see that as being quite a... I mean, I have the decision made for me because we already have Red 1, right?
Yep.
But if I was in a position now of going, well, should I order Red 1? Should I maybe wait for Epic? I think that, you know... I mean, let's face it, right? The Epic is... The base camera cost of the Epic is a lot more than the Red 1.
Sure.
Like it's going to be, what, 40 grand instead of 17. It's a pretty significant hit.
If you think that down the track that you're going to be compromised by, I think if in doubt, go long.
Well, how often would you shoot off speed? How important is off speed to you, just as a director?
Well, I mean, there's always... It depends on the work of the director, you know. I mean, my stuff is pretty real and natural, and the most I'll sort of go is maybe if I'm like doing a serial pour or, you know, something being dropped, or you might do one or two shots where I'll go to 50 frames or 75 frames. Other guys who are doing, you know, car stuff, and they'll sort of go off speed all the time.
So what right now, but what would be the most important thing to you? Like, let's say blank piece of paper.
Yeah.
If you want to go past the Red 1, what's the most significant thing for you? Is it improving the workflow so it's easier to handle in post? Is it improving the frame rate, improving the sensitivity, or improving the making it a bigger...
First thing would be improving the dynamic range.
Okay.
So that when I'm looking at a... If I want to sort of walk into a house that I think looks fantastic and I know on film it's going to look great, and I want to be able to just pull whatever camera out of the box and know that I'll get similar results to film. If you've got a blown-out window, I want that window to blow out kind of how it would on film versus blow out two stops earlier. Than it's that little subtle thing, apart from, you know, shutter speeds, it's that other little subtle thing that says something's a bit tapey, is when windows sort of blow out well before time.
I guess I'd agree with you, except for I'd probably just sneak in low light capability right before I did, because I can actually manage the clipping, but I can't... I think once you get these amazing ISOs that you're getting on stills cameras... Did I tell you that...
But I'm sort of used to comparing it to the ISOs I've had with motion picture stock, that we go to. You know, the most we ever usually go is 500 and maybe push it a bit. And if you push
That's
it a bit,
true,
you
yeah.
can expect a bit of grain.
But most 500 can get grainy.
Yeah, as far as the sensitivity for me anyway, it can do mostly what film does. Again, that comes down to what sort of stuff you what kind of work you do. But for me, it's not blowing out you know, not having windows blow out so quickly, which will come. And also, if I want to go slightly more than 30 frames a second, not have to change to 3K. I'm a big stickler for giving as much of the sensor as possible and not having to change a lens and giving depth, and, you know, not having to change my lens to get the same size shot and then thus make it look a bit more 16mm.
Well, fair enough.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no,
that's
I do.
Probably my two main things. Yeah.
Well, in other news, I respect your opinion. There's no arguing with it, right? It's your opinion, and I respect you in the first
place.
But
you were going to say what your hit list is then.
No, I was just going to say low light capability. I think once you get low light, then it's a no-brainer, film versus digital, to a certain extent, because, you know, when you can work with less light, you can be more creative in your choices because you're not penalizing the production by killing yourself by everything coming out of the van with the barcode reader at the door as you carry the light out.
Well, that's the same thing for me though. If I walk in with a film camera and I've got a woman sort of standing against the window, on the red, I'll have to, my gaffer will have to go and get some gels and start gelling the window. On the film, I'll know, well, it is, the window is blowing
gel's
out.
Gel's like 20 cents, right? Like bloody bunch
of... It's time.
2K, friggin' 1K.
It's time, I just want to get on with it.
Oh, all right. Well, it's not like it doesn't take time to get lights out of the van, but you know.
No,
anyway.
But, I choose my locations because they look great without having to light them too much, I suppose. Again, this comes
down to
style.
I love your style.
It comes down to style. What style? If you really like to light your stuff a lot and spend hours and hours doing it, then great. But I kind of choose locations that look great to begin with, and I like not having to, you know, have to change the lighting too much to suit the actual camera.
No, that's totally valid. I'm a geeky guy who's used to sitting in post trying to get rid of film grain going, bugger. So, no.
To each their own. Everyone's going to have a good hit list, I suppose.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I genuinely think that you're right. Hey, the other thing that came out this week, which we're not really in a position to review, though we will flag, is Red Rushes. So
yeah.
This is another free... It's like an Easter egg, really, a hidden Easter egg. When you download Red Alert, you used to suddenly,
because even you hadn't heard of it.
Well, yeah,
I had to tell Mike about it.
Initially, Redline was like that. You just got this suddenly like script based Red thing, and people were like, "Where did you get that from?" And he goes, "Well, it's just an automatic download in Red Alert. It's hidden in there." And Red Rushes was the same. It's a batch processor for converting rushes. Stack a bunch of clips in there, and it'll convert them out to something else without having to go through, say, a compressor. And that's a useful thing, and I think that's a good thing. And I haven't tested it yet, though we will test it before next week. And when we discuss post-workflow next week, it'll be a good time to discuss Red Rushes. So,
yeah.
But anyway, if you want to have a look at yourself, just download the latest copy of Red Alert, and you'll find that it's a hidden app in there. There's nothing much in the way of anything. It's in 3.38 beta. And so far, the initial reaction across the board has been favourable, but it's only really been out for a few days.
Yeah, it's the first one. There's people requesting, you know, can we do this? Can we add this? Can we add this? And obviously...
Well, audio settings are really critical, I think. But
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll get into that next week.
Okay. What else is there?
Well, I'm really keen to get into this this terrific discussion that you had about DIT on set. Because I think that on-set role is so interesting. It's such a developing area. And you yourself said that you've had, you know, a mixed range of great people to...
Yes.
...experiences.
Yes. Some excellent people and some not.
Excellent people. Yeah. No, but not nasty people. Just
No. It's a very...
it's a new area.
It's a new area, and I think it's really... understood, if that makes sense. It's I think there's a real need for DIT school, or for the whole camera department to start having a think about, the film camera department, I suppose, starting to have a think about how we train up some people, because, you know, like it or not, I quite like it, but like it or not, the digital acquisition era is upon us, and exponentially we're going to need good people. It's not a job you can just plonk onto the loader's job, or get the camera assistant to just pop off at lunchtime and start backing up 20 trillion gigabytes of data. You can't. I think it's a separate, it's a whole separate discipline, and
yeah,
it's a whole separate person on set, really, unfortunately. But you want to have the people, you know, clapper loaders all of a sudden don't have anything to do. They've still got to, you know, help lens changes and work out focus marks and do slates and do all the other stuff they've got to do. So really the data thing is something you just can't leave to, you know, the producer's girlfriend's cousin.
There you go. So we're going to cross in 1 second to Jason's interview. And after that, we'll come back with our geeky discussion on lenses as per your emails. And I want to thank everybody again for the emails you've been sending us. We've been getting phenomenal response to stuff both on Twitter and directly via emails.
Thank you. Yes, and keep it up.
And at the end of that lens discussion, we'll do our weekly Red Room, where we sit down with a Red user, and finally finish up with our Pimp Your Red section. But let's now cross, Jace, to your interview and the DIT.
Okay, I'm talking to Ryan Kunkelman, the DIT technician, who's just finished his second Red film here in Melbourne. And yeah, I've got a chance to talk to him between shoots. thanks for taking the time to talk to me, Ryan.
No problem, no problem.
We've now done two films on Red as DIT. Give us your background and what led you into the role.
Well, my first sort of foray into film was I got a job off of Craigslist, basically doing similar sort of on-set coloring for film. Take digital stills and then bring those into Photoshop and do some correction and then send it off to post for... And then so I worked with Lakeshore on a couple of films, and they sort of thought I fit the bill for doing the DIT stuff when that stuff started coming out. And so Game was started in October, and that was my first Red film, and that was really the first big thing for Red.
Right, okay. So what led you from Game into Knowing?
Well, I ended up getting some good connections through Red, made friends with all the Red folks. And it was actually recommendation through another Red tech who ended up working Yaroon. He's one of their really nice, good Red techs. And I got a call one day, and they wanted to see how soon I could get here. So,
fantastic. Well, you had a lot of assistance as well. Your department kind of grew as you went on the film, I think.
Yeah, that's true. It started out... So on Game, I was doing five cameras by myself, basically. And we were using all cards, 8-gig cards. And so on Knowing, they automatically started us out with two... And then we ended up having like an editorial person, a data coordinator. And then we ended up, when we did second unit, we added another person. So we ended up totally ended up about four people for the most part in our department, more or less.
Okay, well, take us through the workflow with them, the assistants, and with yourself on and off the set from camera to editor, I guess.
Basically, what would happen is they would shoot. We started out shooting mostly cars, and then due to some of the shooting constraints that we were under with the director, he wanted to go back to drives. And so we basically would shoot drives for half a day, and then we'd pull the drives just before lunch and go through the drives, check all the footage for any drop frames or any problems that may have come up, and then run some test color footage through Red Cine real quick, and then I'd export stills of each setup and bring them into Lightroom so the DP could color them later. So I'd export them from Red Cine RAW and then bring them into Lightroom RAW and then do tweaking in Lightroom so that he could change it later and look at different looks next to each other very quickly. And then once we do that, I'd send off an email to the offset data tech who would then go through all the footage at once and color everything and then send that off to dailies. So we're basically doing dailies coloring on set, and then that all got ingested into Avid using MetaCheater, and from there it would go in for dailies viewing.
Right. So what kind of gear are you using on set?
On set, surprisingly enough, I found that laptops with bus-powered hard drives are the best bet for on set, and I had a little Rubbermaid cart. I've also used like a more of a Magliner type card as well. On set, that's the most solid due to power issues and portability and just being able to like run around and not have to worry about power because losing power is bad. And then offset we had a basically like a production trailer with two desktop computers, two 8-core computers. And that's what we would use for any sort of rendering that we needed to do if they wanted to check out a scene. We had some issues with stuff not coming into Avid correctly the first time, and so it would look like there was jumps in the 50-frame footage. And so we'd render out scenes as TIFF sequences and then send them off to editorial. So things like that, or if they wanted to see if there was a scene that was dark, we'd use those computers as sort of our powerhouses to render stuff out.
Do you use any special software as part of the backup process on set?
Yeah, I would do a real quick integrity check of all the footage on set immediately, just sort of checking if there's a problem immediately. And then I'd create a directory tree listing that printed out basically a PDF of all the files in the directories in case something didn't get copied over. We'd know where it happened along. And then also I'd create a CSV, a comma separated value of all the metadata on set, and that we would import that. We have a database that we built, and that way you could access all the footage. And then we also, the stills that I would export were imported in the database so you could see graded and ungraded stills. with all the metadata and any sort of grading information that you want to take a look at.
It sounds pretty complicated. It's a long way from Craigslist.
Yeah.
Obviously, you learned a lot along the way.
Yeah, well, basically, this stuff is all new, so everybody's been learning. I just, it's a lot of random skills that I happen to have before that I was like, why am I learning this, and why do I know this? And then now it's sort of culminating all into this sort of red world, and it's, I'm like, oh, okay, great. This works out then. You know, in my last job I had as a warehouse manager, I had to do a lot of FileMaker programming, and that worked out great for this. So it's sort of a lot of random things that...
Obviously, there's a lot of data involved. You've got sort of up to 5 cameras over, you know, 2 or 3 months. How do you get your head around all that data?
It's just keeping a good track of it, just sort of not taking too big of chunks at a time, being very methodical and very pragmatic with all the how you process it, and just step by step keeping it very simple and not trying to do... That was what was great about having 2 people, because the offset stuff is where most of the real important backup happened. And so that way he's not, you know, he wasn't worried about being on set and dealing with people wanting to look at footage or coloring. He could just focus on the backup and then focus on the you know, the dailies coloring after that was done. So
okay, well, obviously you had a couple of assistants working with you. Take me through the hierarchy of that and whose job was whose.
Okay, well, once I sent stuff offset, after it had been colored and sort of checked, I'd send it offset. Alan, the offset data wrangler, he would plug it into the computer, basically do the same check I just did, just to ensure that immediately everything was there and there was no problems. And then once he did that, then he would immediately do a copy to a... We had a RAID 5 set up on one computer. And then once that was done, he would do another copy onto a transport drive. That's what we sent to editorial. And then once he did that, then he would color the footage from the RAID 5 on the desktop and then copy all the RSX files over to the transport drive that went to editorial. That way we were never actually modifying any of the original footage. We were only just accessing it temporarily. And then so once that was all done, we were breaking twice a day that way editorial, because they were trying to get dailies out daily, like actual dailies, which is, yeah. Doesn't seem like it's been happening as much, though, recently. Even with all the digital stuff, it's still quite a bit of a delay, but they're really adamant about making sure that we got dailies daily. And so it was definitely interesting sometimes trying to organize all that. They're like, can't you just not eat lunch? And it's like, no.
Well, did you have a different sort of setup when you were out on location?
Well, we had, like I said, we had the production trailer, and so... You know, as long as we had power, everything was pretty solid as far as that went. And then me on set with a laptop was sort of... And then once we did second unit, Alan did everything for the second unit stuff on a laptop, all the coloring, all the backup. He had a portable, I think it was a G-RAID, a G-Safe. And so it was a mirrored backup, so that he had that. And then so that way there was, you know, everything was still backed up in a similar method.
Because... Obviously, the role of DIT is really, I suppose, should be more nowadays seen as an addition to the camera department rather than just, this is some extra workload for the loader. It really is evolving into a whole separate role.
Yeah, it really is, and that's something that's really important for, you know, productions to keep in mind. It's you basically end up being the sort of the DP's best friend or safety net or, you know, confidant, however you want to say it, but it's really... You know, you have their back, and there's a certain amount of knowledge that you have to have. You know, I'm an aspiring DP myself, and so, you know, that's sort of, and Alan's an aspiring colorist, and so it's sort of, those sort of skill sets are really what set apart a data wrangler versus, like, a data tech or, you know, a DIT. So it's really, there's quite a difference. You know, we're looking for, you know, proper exposure and the highlights and making sure that the histogram's correct and not just like making sure the data's there, you know, and looking at a scene overall and coloring it and going, is this going to work? If it's day for night, is everything working right? You know, do we need to call over the DP and say, hey, you know, take a look at this, just check it out and see if this is what you, is this right? You know, just, you know, if something comes up or, and then you're looking at things like moiré, you know, are you having problems with reflections, you know, something they might not catch in a down converted HD image.
You're really being the onset lab.
Exactly. It's sort of a mix between loader, lab, and a little bit of post-production as well.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, that's a lot to handle, and that's really why the loader should be left to do, you know, not necessarily the loading, but he's got to do slates, lens changes, helping the first AC out, and really it is two separate roles. I think there is definitely a need for, like, DIT school to start producing some great people to fill this role, because there's a real need for more people out there who can do this.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, someone owning a camera doesn't necessarily mean that they're a qualified applicant for a DIT role. I mean, there's so many little things that, you know, like noticing what happens when the black shading needs to get reset, like little things that are very subtle, that it's not, if you're not doing it on a daily basis, you're not going to know what to look for. So it's definitely, and it's not even something that can always be taught either, which is unfortunate. You know, we had that experience because we brought in an extra guy to cover for Alan when he went to second unit, and it was sort of, we're like, well, here's basically what we're doing, but, you know, we're going to have to show you as stuff happens what it means and what the implications are along the line. So
you got to learn it by doing it, I guess.
Definitely. And it's a different skill set than a loader or a camera assistant. It's, you know, because I assisted on a couple of small independent things, and, you know, it's a blast, but it's a whole different, you know, they're dealing with completely different world, especially in digital. If it's something that's coming from a feature background, film-wise, it's a whole different, you know, animal completely.
So what did you learn from Game that you employed on Knowing? You're laughing.
Well, we started on build 12, and first day of the shoot, we actually, the very first shot was a running, like a stunt shot running through an explosion. Camera shut off every single time halfway through the shot, and they're all looking at me, and I'm saying, look, I've held this camera for a week now. This is, you know, we've all had the, you know, like a week of prep on this thing, and we have no idea. So basically, you know,
shot one day one.
So next day, Red's out there helping us out and getting us, you know, I think it ended up there was extra on off buttons that we disabled and things like that, so it was something that got fixed really quickly and really easily, thanks to them. But yeah, so many things change along the way, and every week it was before the forums were really, they're getting stronger, but the forums weren't very strong then, because, no, I mean, there just wasn't that experience. And
well, obviously the shoot's not quite over yet, but what's everybody's take out so far from doing a feature on the Red? And a lot of the guys there have come from film backgrounds. What's their, what are they walking away with, do you think?
I think it varies a lot from person to person. You know, producers love it. It's fantastic. They can, you know, they have immediate assurance of footage, you know, more so with cards, if you shoot cards, than drives. But it took a little while for the director to get used to. It's one of those things when you're looking at a film nag and dailies, you know, he's been doing it for so long. You look at a film nag and dailies and you go, okay, it looks crappy, but I know exactly what we can do with this nag. And he's looking at colored dailies that are digital on a consumer projector, and he goes, what is this image, what does this mean to me, you know? So it takes a lot of time to really sort of get used to that whole aspect with the digital, especially for a very technical director like Alex is.
So what do you think the takeout is?
I think overall it's positive. I definitely, you know, it's still in the growth stages, and people are sort of still a little bit skeptical, even the people we've been using it, you know. It's one of those things that you definitely have to sort of tread lightly and know what you're doing and sort of be very methodical about it and understand that it's a new technology still. Even though it's build 15 and it's great, and, you know, there's still problems, and it's still, you know, just as with anything, you know, film scratches or hairs in the gate or, you know, light leaks in the mag, or, you know, it's just a different set of problems.
So the DP, Simon Duggan, he owns one of the cameras that he was shooting with. Do you think he's ready to throw it in the ocean or buy another one?
I think he's all ready to buy an Epic. He loves it. He thinks it's fantastic. I think, and that's what, you know, having a strong crew behind you can really, really help you grab onto this, the technology, and really take advantage of what it can do, you know, and having, you know, having been through the process and having, you know, we walked him through and said, okay, look, this is what we can do. You know, we can make it look like this, or we can make it look like this. We can make it look flat. We can show you all the highlights that are there. We can, you know, show you all the shadows, bring it up. You know, you can see exactly how it looks, and, you know, that'll give you an idea for when you're metering, you can go, okay, I know in my head this is what it's going to look like. You know, that's sort of what we were able to do through prep and then throughout the shoot, just sort of get him used to the idea of, you know, what it can do. And I think it, he definitely loved it. And I think overall it was a good experience for him.
Excellent. Okay, so what's next for you?
Vacation. Yeah, I think I'm probably going to take like at least a month off. I'm looking, you know, there's quite a few things coming up. So this, I think, you know, some other companies I've worked with before has some projects coming up. So, you know, you can never say for sure with this business, but, you know, there's definitely other red stuff. I've already gotten calls for stuff that I had to turn down. So,
well, I'm sure it's not back to Craigslist for you.
For sure.
So for someone who wants to just set up a simple onset DIT setup, just for, say, you know, a TVC or, you know, a short film, what would you recommend as a good basic setup?
If you're, if it's a small project, you definitely, you can go with a laptop, and then any sort of mirrored storage that you can get power to easily. I think, you know, in the day and age of digital, it's so important to have multiple copies in different locations. And I might even, if the budget allows, recommend getting an LTO tape machine, just so you have a semi-hard copy, as much as a hard copy as that is. But yeah, it's so important. I mean, we haven't, luckily haven't had any big problems with that, but I'm just waiting for the day, you know, you don't want to get that call, and it's, if you can just cover your ass as much as you can, then you don't have to worry about that.
Okay, well, where can people find you?
Well, my email address is reddatatech@gmail.com.
That's easy. Excellent. Okay, and ryankunkelman.com.
Yeah, ryankunkelman.com. I've got some photography and some other, you know, type stuff like that, small, crappy old demo reel, since I've been working so much.
Well, you might have to change the website now, plugging the DIT side.
Yeah, that's what I'm shooting some music videos at the end of this month, actually DPing them. So I'm hoping to slowly, you know, get away from the DIT and head towards the DP. But, you know, in the time being, yeah, the DIT, maybe put some color samples up of the coloring on set and that sort of thing. At one point, Simon actually was like, are you going to be available maybe to do the final coloring? I was like, okay. But that probably, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, they've got that all lined up.
I'm sure. But it's a great grounding. You know, technically, a fantastic grounding to have essentially almost worked on set and at the lab in the same space, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely a huge, especially working, having started, you know, my first film job, basically doing the same thing with film and understanding the whole process from the film perspective, and then being able to explain it to a DP or a camera assistant from the film perspective versus the digital perspective, I think is a huge, huge help.
Great. Well, look, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it. Good luck with the rest of the shoot, and we'll catch up.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you.
Well, that was a really good interview. And while I had heard that interview before, we managed to sneak out and have a look at, or rather show Jace, the Knowing trailer, which only just came out.
That is a cool trailer. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. That is a cracker. That looks, I want to see it now.
Yeah, actually, I was kind of disappointed when I heard that The Wanting wasn't actually, Wanted wasn't actually shot on the Red. Very disappointed, but then I was very pleased to then see the...
To see the result.
Yeah, to see the Knowing stuff.
Oh, I see. Great. I thought you'd seen the actual film Wanted and thought, thank God that wasn't on Red, because it looks pretty rubbish to me.
No. I'm not dishing the... I actually saw Get Smart the other day on shot on Genesis,
mm-hmm.
and it had bits that looked... it looked like digital cinema. Honestly, it looked video, but it looked like definitely like digital cinematography. It gave it away.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess it's a very sort of clean kind of look from what I've seen from the trailer anyway.
Yeah, it's not that. It's almost a smearing kind of thing that you get in some shots, almost like it's not got a 180-degree shutter at some points. Oh, that's what tripped it for me.
Bad move. That's the first thing for me too.
Okay, so let's now shift gears and have our quick discussion, or quick discussion. I've never been known to talk about anything quickly.
A discussion.
Our discussion about lenses, because somebody asked us to do it, and we, you know, each week like to tackle a topic, and sometimes those are random topics which we fall into in terms of our, I think we come up with a better term than rat holes, but our technical diversions, and others we. So I think the key thing about discussing lenses, and certainly one of the things I wanted to raise is, people often say, you know, is that a good lens or not? Or, you know, how do you like it and stuff? And I think there are really two answers to this. There's the most obvious answer, which is just...
Yeah, I just like it.
Well, what were you shooting on in Melbourne?
We had two cameras. So we had a set of Cook S4s, and we also had some of those Russian lenses, which I'd never used before. But I think we might have mentioned it on very early on an earlier episode. Not Epics, Elites.
Right.
Which look, as soon as I saw a few pictures of them, but as soon as I had one in my hand, I thought, hang on, this is like someone's just shipped, the Russians have rented a set of of Cooks, and a set of Master Primes. They just looked exactly and felt exactly like it. Just looked like the Russian space shuttle, you know.
Now, I can't comment on those lenses because I've not used them, but they are priced at a fairly competitive price range, right? Like most of the primes are around $6,500?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you what a set of, you know, proper Cook lenses are, really, but yeah, they're about $6,500 each. Most of them about 1.3s. But yeah, they seem very nice. We were running two cameras, and so far, I mean, pretty early in the edit days, but we were cutting them together. They look like they cut pretty well together with the Cooks so far.
So I've been shooting in Adelaide, and well, you've been doing your... Was it babies you were shooting in?
Afraid so.
Well, you were shooting babies in Melbourne. I was shooting stop-frame animation for fxphd.com over at Anaphex. And we used the red lens, and the reason we used the 18-50 is that it actually has really close focus. So, you know, the lens actually is... focusing well. I say it focuses about 8 inches in front of the what I'd call the film plane or the image plane. If you actually look at what that means in terms of the lens, it means about half an inch in front of the front of it. Except for if you look on the website, it'll list that that's actually 1¾ inches in front
from
of
lens
the lens
front. Yeah,
I call the lens front the bit that's plastically inseparable from the rest of the lens. They're obviously measuring from the glass.
Lens element, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm measuring from just, you know, if you try and butt it up against something.
Either way, that's bloody amazing.
Yeah, so that's what I was shooting on, and I was really happy with that. You know, we were not doing killer complicated stuff from a lens point of view, I guess, but it was nice. But so we get to this discussion. It's like, well, what makes for a good lens, and why would you like one lens over another? And there's, you know, absolutely nothing wrong with just saying, I like the look of this lens. This lens just looks sweet. But being geeks, certainly over here at PhD, we like to sort of quantify things. And so that's what I wanted to discuss, basically. What are the sort of measurements and things that affect what makes a good lens, and to a certain extent, how is Red stacking up? So let's first by summarize what we have on offer from Red right now. There's the 18-50, which we spoke about earlier.
Yep.
The 50-150, which I just declined, but only so I could get a new one later. Yep. And the 300. And then there will be a set of primes coming out from those guys, which is a 25, a 35, 50, 85, 100, and 300, with a 15 and an 18mm lenses to follow in the kind of a second batch.
Yeah.
And then, as I indicated, I'm hanging out for that 18-85. Okay, so those are the lenses, and, you know, like the current ones, the 18-50 that I use, it's about 2.3 pounds. The one I rejected, the 50-150, is about 3.3 pounds.
Yep.
And they're not huge lenses, and they're nice lenses, but they're significant in, I guess, two big areas. One is there are no actual camera markings on the actual housings, so they're not calibrated to the level that you'd expect from a top-of-the-line lens. There's no individual markings for distance, for example. It's just a number next to the notch, and you have to kind of, you know, you can't say with the same degree of accuracy that is exactly 3 feet away. And the second thing is they're darn cheap.
Well, I've had a bit of a look at these things, but I didn't realise there was all those emissions in the markings. What are we saying, that there's just not enough? Not
well, no. In on a, like say a Cook lens, right?
Yeah.
You can use it as a measuring instrument because you can literally focus at something,
right,
and then it'll have a little niche notch kind of cut into the lens at 15 feet or whatever,
mm-hmm,
that says 15, and you could line that up with your notch, and you'd be okay, I'm exactly at 15 feet. That those notches on a say a Cook lens are done individually. Each lens is put on a testing piece of apparatus. They actually calibrate each one, put a piece of gaffer tape around,
mm,
and notch it, and then that notching is etched into your particular lens.
Mm.
Whereas Red are more mass produced and don't have that.
Sure. Well, look, I think with all sort of focus stuff, you really rely on the markings. But obviously you also rely on what you're looking through the lens, but you also rely on running it, on getting eye marks. So, but yeah, a lot of the times if you don't have time, you really have to, focus pullers will just say, okay, I'll wing it. And he is totally guided by guessing out there and going by the mark, but the markings be right. I'm sure the markings are right, but it's great to have a bit more accurate.
Okay, so let's move now from the sort of emotional response you might have, which is, as I say, completely valid, down to discussing what are the sort of technical aspects that really influence what a lens is like. And there's about five or six of them, Jace, and I'm going to try and tackle them pretty much in order.
Yep.
And the first one is contrast. Now, people often talk about what's the resolution of a lens and or what's the resolution of a camera. And we know that you can't resolve something perfectly to the spec. So, for example, the new Scarlett, right? The new Scarlett is a 3K camera, but it'll actually resolve to about 2.1K, which is about 72% of 3K. In the same way, we put up the best lens we've got on our Red right now. We're not resolving to 4K. This is natural. Like, it is a 4K camera. It just doesn't fully resolve there, nor would an HD camera fully resolve to HD.
Sure.
Okay, now some of the issues that are going on there, in the case of a lens, you actually have some loss of light and loss of quality as it goes through the optical characteristics of the lens. So obviously light has to come in, bounce around on a bit of glass, ends up somewhere, and along the way you do have to pay a price. You can't get anything for free. And so so that is an aspect of what's happening with the contrast. So why is contrast so important? Well, you think that resolution is what you care about the most, but actually contrast is a really significant aspect to it. So if you were to hold a piece of paper about, I don't know, 14 inches away from your head, which is kind of a good kind of reading distance, and you were to have... Now, the way they measure this is they have lines, and it's normally either a line per millimeter or actually two lines per millimeter. And so let's say we have two lines per millimeter, and you wanted to see whether or not you could resolve something. Well, you could have poor resolution on the thing that you're holding 14 inches from your head. If it had really good contrast, you could still resolve it, even though you didn't have the resolution in the original picture. If you had, however, less contrast, you'd need more resolution. And the two really affect each other. And so there's a whole concept of an MTF, which is a modulated transfer function. And what we tend to measure is the readability of those lines, and it's a function of resolution and contrast. And if you have a lens that doesn't have the same contrast, it will appear to be less sharp, it will appear to have less resolution, it'll appear to not be as fine, as sharp, as good. And so, for example, if we put up our 18-50 against a Cook prime lens, so right away that's a harsh thing to do, because a prime lens is never going to be as good as a zoom lens is never going to be good as a prime.
Yeah.
But if you put an S4 prime up against a Red zoom, you're going to notice that there is in fact less contrast.
Or any zoom.
And any zoom, yeah. But you'll notice that there's less contrast, and so you tend to perceive that the lens is less sharp. And that's why you often see these charts that people are pointing cameras at all the time, because they're trying to work out how much you can resolve to on the chart, but the resolution of the chart is only half the problem. The problem is also, as I say, in terms of how much it can hold contrast, and that is a function of just putting light through glass.
Yeah, and it is, they do work together, the combination of the sharpness of the lens, but also how much contrast is. If you're trying to resolve these sort of lines here, you're just trying to basically sort of, where does it fall off if you've got... if it might be quite sharp, but if the contrast isn't there, it's gonna sort of fall apart even earlier.
Yeah. So when we're looking at a 4K section of a proper test chart that's got the resolution in terms of the printing, and we look at that file electronically, it looks grey. Now we've zoomed in now, of course, to the 4K very fine lines, but the black white are so fine, and the camera can't resolve that contrast, it becomes just a grey patch. And that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's just what you're looking for. You're looking for good contrast in the lens. So the next thing I would rate in terms of it is that you want the lens to defocus evenly. You want both the left and the right to defocus. And here we have to introduce a new term, which is a broquet. Now, broquet is the way at which it defocuses. And this is it's a Japanese word. And it's
B-O-K-E-H?
It's actually B-O-K-E-N, but it's pronounced, depending on where you learnt about it, broquet. And it's kind of popularity, and I guess in the 90s, when we were trying to qualify the almost artistic nature of the defocus. Does it look like a nice defocus? Is it like so we wanted to qualify that or quantify that. And that's what this term came up with. Now, there's a bunch of maths involved in how this works, but basically, if you're not focusing correctly on the backplane, you defocus, and how that defocuses is very much affected by the aperture in the lens, the actual number of slashes in the little, you know, James Bond irisy thing that's happening inside your lens.
And I think that this is probably the one factor for me, as more of a, as I suppose, more of the director hat on than the DP. That I would say, yeah, I love these lenses versus something else. And I would say it's the bokeh. I'm going to call it bokeh because that's how I pronounce it.
Looks, you know, you'd probably be right. I'm probably mispronouncing it.
That it just looks different. And it comes back to that thing of I don't know what I like, I just like it. Is that the difference between, say, like a set of just size standards and a set of Cook S4s is that bokeh, is that how beautiful. It's just a totally different quality in out of focus backgrounds. And as I said before, I kind of like to work a lot of longer lenses, and I just know that if you set up the same shot with a guy standing there 5 foot from the camera, just like a medium shot on a 50mm lens or whatever, and you swapped it between a Zeiss standard and a Cook S4, the Cook is just going to look outstandingly different.
Yeah, now that there's a lot of things that are contributing to that, and we're obviously not going to get into the maths of it, and not least of which is you'll hear people talking about the area of confusion. But all you need to understand is that the way that that happens, the way that that defocuses, is actually, as Jason said, one of the big determining factors in terms of the aesthetic appreciation of whether you like the lens or not. I guess the next technical one for me would be the breathing on the lens. So you've heard people talking about the lens breathing or not, and there's two things to consider here. One is what you'd call breathing in terms of a zoom. So as I zoom the shot, I want the picture to move evenly through the zoom, and also as I go in and out, I want it to move evenly. But it's the zooming around the apparent zooming around the focus adjustment that is really what we're worried about here. And I'll tell you why. Let's say I'm operating for Jason, and Jason wants me to have one of his very shallow depth of field, looks gorgeous, and somebody's walking through shot. Now, I may have to hunt around to find focus while pulling that. In other words, I need to adjust the focus dynamically through the shot, and I have to kind of hunt to nail it. In other words, I go a little bit one way, oops, starting to go out of focus, I'll come back a bit. Now, in fact, you won't really notice that. If a good good camera operator is doing that, you won't notice it. That hunting to find focus is a skill. Yes, they're like just touching either side of the acceptability envelope, but it's okay. Except if it breathes.
Yeah.
And as you adjust the focus, if it breathes, the whole image appears to zoom while he's just adjusting the focus knob. And man, you can notice that sucker.
Yeah, breathing is essentially zooming that the focus does. If you change the focus from 6 feet to 10 feet, you actually notice the shot get wider or tighter. And that is, yeah, that's essentially is the definition of breathing. And good lenses don't do it.
So, working our way down from
do it less.
Yeah, exactly. Working our way down from our personal sort of list of most important to least important, we're still about halfway through. There's now some stuff to do with the coatings on the lenses, and this appears in two areas pretty much. And partly these are simplifications, but one area is chromatic aberration. And chromatic aberration is that, let's say on the wide side of a zoom or on a very wide angle lens, over on the edges, the picture seems to separate into RGB almost, and you get a fringing down one side. And that's a chromatic aberration caused by the way the lens is built, effectively.
Chromatic aberration.
Did I not say that?
Chromatic.
Oh, am I getting every word wrong today? Okay, I call it chromatic. What do you call it?
Chromatic.
Chromatic?
Chroma.
Chromatic, okay. So we've pretty much proven that I'm good at maths and Jason is good at English. And that is absolutely true. I'm crap at English. Okay, so, but here's the, I'm going to change subject now because I can...
Yeah, it's mainly around the highlights. You'll notice that if you've got hotter stuff, and it does happen mostly out of the corners of frames, that, yeah, you'll notice if you zoom in on anything, just grab your digital any happy snap and just zoom in and look on the fringes, you'll notice that highlights particularly will get a bit of a blue edge. That's actually the blue part of the spectrum sort of being shifted. Yeah, is that right?
Yep, absolutely. And I mean, you'll tend to see sometimes green on one side and red on the other as they do that. Now, that's one thing. The other thing that's really interesting and again borders on the creative is the way that the camera flares. And let me explain that. We obviously understand camera flares to be incredibly dicky, crappy Photoshop plugins. And I'm not necessarily just referring to that, though obviously that's related to it. But if you flare a shot, it will also start to fog. And that flaring, that fogging flaring, is bad. That's like, that's reducing contrast and making the picture kind of look muddy. The classic Panavision anamorphic lens flare that they somehow tried to imitate in Photoshop and failed so badly at, some people actually quite like.
Oh, like, I love flares. I mean, obviously, if you're after it, you might go start chasing particular kinds of lenses that will give you, you know, the flares, because obviously as optics progress, they try and get rid of all that stuff. It's sometimes, you know, like, you want that sort of analog feel out of an instrument, you've got to start digging the old stuff out of the box. And it's the same with lenses. If you want to get some interesting looks in the sort of lens flare department, you have to start sort of finding the older stuff. So, and it varies from manufacturer to manufacturer, and varies from a lot of the high speed lenses are flary and do tend to sort of fog up a little bit, and you have to sort of watch that a bit.
Yeah, and it's as I say, related to the coatings on the parts in the lens. Now, it is arguable that you want that that sort of, you know, diamondy thing that we call a lens flare. It's probably less arguable that you want the picture just to fog up and look crap.
Mm.
But that's something that we have to consider when judging the lens. Okay, so now we're getting down to the lesser evils, I guess, and one of them is vignette. So if the lens doesn't adequately deal with the sensor pickup, in other words, doesn't have kind of enough distance around, it can start to fall off in light levels around the edges, and that causes a vignetting, and particularly noticeable on wide-angle lenses. And that vignetting is just what we'd expect. It's the same thing we reintroduced to make pictures look cool in telecine. But obviously on a panning shot, you don't want that, and most people don't like it at the capture stage. And so what you want, especially like on any kind of technical level, is just for very even light levels across the lens. But that is hard to do.
Yeah, and obviously, yeah, that's the kind of thing you want to put it in later, and you don't want to have it there to begin with. As you say, you start sort of panning around, you're looking at blue skies and things, and you start noticing that everything sort of drops off towards the corners. It's something that stills lenses do all the time, but a lot of the cameras now even compensate for it, you know.
And then there is a concept that also we would test for on a lens, which is called centerline drift. Now, centerline drift is how much it doesn't stay centered as you go through the zoom. And centerline drift, for example, is not particularly good on our Red 18-50. It's not appalling, it's just not good. Now, having said that, it's probably the least creatively annoying technical aspect of a lens.
Yeah, I've never really seen it too badly. So basically, that means that if you've got a zoom, you line up on a wide shot, and say you're zooming into a window on a office block the other side of the street. If you line up on center up on that window in your crosshairs on your wide lens, you zoom in, and you're now looking at a totally other window over the other side or whatever. I mean, obviously you'd pan to correct it, but most good lenses aren't going to do that too much. But yeah, I think it's also called tracking sometimes.
Yeah, and so probably not something that's going to bug you right out of the gate. Certainly nothing like contrast is, in terms of just looking at a shot and going, wow. But somewhat related to that, though only creatively, certainly not technically, is just the mechanics of the lens, right? And some people like the feel of a, you know, S4, because it's really well made and it feels really well engineered, and there's no give in the kind of apparatus. It feels like a precision piece of cool stuff, and it is.
Mm. But, you know, get what you pay for. I mean, obviously, we don't want to be too elitist about the lenses and stuff. I mean, I think for me, it just comes... I don't really care where the good look comes from. If you can get this nice sort of bokeh, if you get that beautiful out-of-focus stuff in the background from another lens, then great. I'm sure there's, you know, pretty much most lenses these days are built pretty well. I mean, you've actually noticed this tracking thing on your 18-50.
Yeah, we did technical run-throughs to basically check all of these aspects. Mm-hmm. I mean, the last one, just to finish up for us, is the pin cushioning effect, which is to say the amount of curvature on the lens as at the wide level versus at the close-up. And so on this particular case, if you were, for example, as we did, we moved the lens very close to the chart and framed it so that the test chart was just on the edge of frame on the wide lens. Ran all the way back to the other side of the room, zoomed in, so the test chart was just on the edge of frame. So theoretically, those pictures would look the same, right? Except for on the wide lens, the edges of the pictures were bent a bit, and on the zoom, they were all very, very straight. Now, that's natural, but obviously how much it does that, how straight your lens is, especially on the wide end, is something that's of interest to people. And also, it relates to why we're desperate for Red to implement the iTech option on the lenses.
Right, so how does that help us?
Well, on the iTech version of the lenses, and this is sort of built into the Red spec and not yet implemented, though perilously close, and we implore you to encourage Red to go the last yards to close this out. The lens has a chip built into it, which actually records what the lens is doing at every time, up to about 100 times a second. So if I was to zoom a shot, I would go from straight edges to not so straight edges as I went from a long lens to a wide lens. Now that kind of plays havoc a little with 3D tracking software and stuff, because 3D tracking software would love it if straight lines were straight lines. And CG loves straight lines being straight lines. So clearly what we'd love to do is be able to convert our bent footage to straight footage, just so that when we put CG in it, they all line up. Even if at the end of the process we then go and bend it back to make it look kind of all filmic and optical. And that's hard to do on a zoom lens, because on a single, you know, normal prime lens, I can shoot a test chart, I can kind of work out how much curvature is in the shot, I can then sort of straighten out my test chart and then apply that straightening out to every piece of footage shot on that prime lens, right? So Jason decides to shoot buildings on a S4, you know, wide lens, or let's say he just grabs a 25mm lens and shoots some stuff.
Yeah.
I separately grab the lens, shoot my test chart, work out, okay, so this has this much bend in it, and every one of his building shots I just unbend to match the test chart. Not so easy on a zoom shot. And so what happens with the iTech data is, this is just one of the things that it does, it records all the information of the focus, the zoom, and all the settings that you would consider like... you know, on the actual lens itself. And yeah, they go to a little meta file which gets written into the R3D. Now, when I then go to do 3D tracking, the first thing that you would love to know when you're doing 3D tracking is what lens you shot on. And normally you look at a piece of paper and it says, oh, well, I think we shot this on a 25, and so you're tempted to punch in 25 and hope that was correct. Well, obviously, in the case of a 3D tracking program that would use the iTech data, it would just look up, hey, this was shot on a 25mm lens. It would then use that data to solve the 3D track. But of course, if it's a zoom, it can now not only look up what the lens was at the beginning of the shot, but all the way through the shot to work out how to solve the shot. And then it can compensate for the curvature that we've been talking about, because it actually has the serial number of the lens, it knows the model number, and it can look up based on charts that are published by the manufacturer at the point of which the camera was made. And de-bend the picture dynamically through the shot mathematically perfectly to, like, I think we went to 4 or 5 decimal places on our testing. And what this means is that you're dynamically adjusting a shot to keep it straight throughout a zoom with 1/100th of a second precision. And this just is glorious.
And focus. And how focus affects
distortion. You'll know the focus, you'll know everything. So the 3D guys would just open the file up and say, okay, at this point it's focused at 8 feet, and wow, you know, that was on a 32 and it's halfway through a zoom and I can match that in 3D.
So this software is out there now and all of this is If we had the lenses now working, you'd be actually able to implement all this.
Yeah, absolutely. And Red has promised to do it, and it's built into the cameras, yep. And it's just on the list. And we just want them to get it to the top of the list.
So at the moment, there's obviously, I mean, people make lenses with this system in there already. Arri,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So and Arri cameras, I think.
The thing about them is, you know, like on a Cook lens, for example, there's a little eye tap off the side, and so you can basically take out this iTech data and write it to a separate SD card. The problem then is really that you have to then resync the rushes for both audio and iTech data, and that's kind of annoying because, you know, plus you have to get into the camera department and say, do you mind if I hook up a cable to your lens and make sure that this thing's switched on and make sure that somebody logs the thing, and it's like...
So once this is implemented, it's a great tool for special effects.
Once it's implemented, you won't have to do any of that. You'll simply grab any R3D file, shot with a lens, either Red's lenses, because they've got it, or somebody else's that implements it, and simply say, hey, what was this shot on? What was the focus at this point in time? And unless I don't think it's going to matter, but obviously up to 1/100th of a second, you're going to go, yep, I can tell you exactly where you're focused, what your exposure was, and I can tell you where you were on the zoom at this point in time.
So we already love it for green screen. You already like it because it's just digital acquisition, so it's going to be a bit sharper anyway. So once they sort of switch this all on, it's going to be... I mean, it's already quite an embedded camera for effects anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the rolling shutter, as we've discussed, yes, is
sure.
an issue.
It is.
But definitely I would find the iTech to counterbalance the... and presumably, in fact, they've said that they will let you write your own metadata. So, for example, a lot of people were thinking, oh, well, I could write a GPS thing, which would feed GPS coordinates into my camera. So if I had a helicopter flying over New York, I would have metadata that would actually had the GPS coordinates of where the camera was to whatever degree of accuracy the GPS is spitting out, and that would write into the metadata feed in exactly the same way. So I think the metadata is great. I think, you know, now that Build 16's out, I really like Red to get around to... And I should say, I know for a fact it isn't just they haven't got around to it. There is some minor hardware issues as well that they've been solving, but hopefully now it can get some bandwidth and some attention.
With the pins in the mounts, etc.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, the cameras are shipping without the pins at the moment.
Yeah, so it would require a mod, but it's a field modification.
Not everyone's going to want it. People that want it, obviously, you can be able to get it done.
I want it a lot.
I'm sure. Special effects. I'm sure special effects guys would just absolutely love it. If you can have, and then I guess you can have, can you plug in all the sort of, like if you've got a sort of pan tilt or a MoCo rig, you can start pumping all that stuff into
I mean, it's just the second that we allow us to have effectively user metadata feeding, there's all bets are off. There's so much stuff that you can be chucking in there. I mean, you could obviously have something that was an inclinometer that was giving you the angle at which the camera was tilting at and just feeding that information in through the USB port and in. There's a ton of stuff.
Yeah, accelerometers, all sorts.
Oh, yeah, you know, on the Red that you can just play with once it all gets done. I mean, obviously, they're focused on the important things first, which is, you know, image quality. But, hey, you know, before we get on to Epic, let's get some of the other stuff implemented on the one we've already got.
Right. Okay. So, what's next?
Well, I think that pretty much covers our additional lenses, other than to say, how does the Red lens stack up in these areas? And I'd have to say that this would be my personal opinion. You could all, you know, flame me if you like. But I would say, if we look at, say, the 18 to 50, it does have good contrast. It's not as good as a prime lens, but it does have good contrast and is definitely punching above its weight. It does defocus evenly, which is good. There is some issues with zooming and stuff, and oftentimes I will say, especially on just the mechanical nature of the lens, that I tend to use it like a variable prime more than I use it for actually zooming during shot.
Sure.
It has very low chromatic aberration and vignetting, so it's scoring very well there. I didn't find that it was a problem in terms of the flaring. I found it to be not a big deal. I was more concerned about the earlier problems about, you know, the sun going to a black dot and stuff. I don't know if you've found anything with flaring, but...
No.
I mean, I can flare my really expensive 5D Canon lenses, right? So, and fog them.
Sure.
So it's just, you know, you got to watch it.
Yeah, look, I just haven't used the Red lenses a lot because obviously if we're on a shoot, we want a whole, you know, we want to have a whole
box of them.
A whole box of them. They're all going to sort of match and, going to work. So obviously, eventually you'll be able to do that in Redland for sure.
I had a bit of problem with centerline drift, not unacceptable. None of these are at the point at which I think they're, like, appalling. And the pin cushioning, there was obviously some pin cushioning going on, as I'd kind of expect. So I would have, and I've often said this in the past, actually, I would rate this as kind of, as in terms of a zoom lens, it's about a $30,000 lens versus a sort of a $70,000 top of the line zoom lens. And yet it's costing, you know, six or thereabouts, yeah. 6,000. So it's
same bang for your buck that you get for your red.
Yeah, it's a lot better value than we're seeing almost anywhere else. No, it doesn't outgun the big boys. And, you know, I'm very, very happy that they provide these lenses that we can use them.
Absolutely. It sort of all goes together. You're providing the lenses, affordable lenses that people, a lot of people own their own cameras, and these are affordable to own lenses. You know, a lot of the other stuff that I'm talking about, stuff that, you know, is only a viable purchase if you're renting it out all the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they're really expensive. It's ridiculous. Half the time, you know, half the time the lens bill, rental bill, can be as much as the camera bill. You know, it's quite ridiculous, really. So eventually that'll change, obviously.
So I guess that's it, other than we've got two things left to do. I guess we should go to your terrifically left of the obvious Red Room, which, you know, I really want to applaud you for managing to get a non-Australian accent in there.
Absolutely. Well, look, I put the feelers out to all. Well, I mean, okay, my next victim is a guy called Abdullah Muhammad Mustaki. I hope, apologies if I'm mispronouncing that, Abdullah. He's a great guy. He is working in Abu Dhabi. He is the director of Emirates Film Corporation. He's on the board of directors of the Middle East International Film Festival and the board of directors of the Abu Dhabi Film Commission. He's a very busy man. He's one of those little icons on Red User that keeps popping up every once in a while. I go, oh, that's an interesting looking guy. It was great to have a chat with him. And yeah, here he is.
Hey, how are you, mate?
Very good. How are you?
Pretty good.
Thanks, Abdullah, for joining me in the Red Room.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay. Well, first I'll start with what Red One you have and how did you come to buy it?
I've got the Red One, Red 707, and I just heard about it at DV Info, and I was pretty stunned by it, by the first images, by the people, and it was just, I mean, I got it because it's really very convenient, and I mean, it's really cheap. I mean, it's very affordable, not exactly cheap for the indie guy, but it's very affordable, and it's fabulous. I mean, what it produces is just amazing. It's astounding.
Well, I'll take people through your credits here listed on the bottom of your email. You're the director of the Emirates Film Competition. You're on the board of directors of the Middle East International Film Festival and one of the board of directors of Abu Dhabi Film Commission.
Yes.
How does the red fit into that picture?
It worked for me. Since we have a film competition, it's kind of the only film competition, the only film festival that is based towards, you know, building the grassroots of the film industry in the GCC. I mean, you would have probably heard of films from Egypt, for example, or I mean, other areas of the Middle East, but none from the GCC. Like, we would not ever see a film from Saudi Arabia, from the United Arab Emirates, or, I mean, from this region in particular. And basically, we're the guys, the Emirates Film Competition is the competition that started this whole indie industry, indie filmmaking industry. So, I mean, it's the first thing that ever started. I mean, the first film competition, the first word to be spoken of film. And it all started with basically video. So we did not have any film making at all for the past 30 years, and we just started like 7 years ago. So we stumbled upon Red, and it's just, you know, it's an amazing thing what this thing does.
So obviously you say it's convenient, because clearly there's probably no infrastructure there whatsoever for film processing or any of the handling, I guess, to shoot a real film.
Exactly.
So obviously, I guess now with stuff like the Red, you can, from go to woe, do the whole film in-house.
Yeah, definitely. We've got a lot of production companies in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. I mean, they do, but most of the works are commercial. I mean, they make commercials, they make corporate videos, and even film. I mean, a lot of film is shot. I mean, The Kingdom, when they came down here, I was one of the producers on The Kingdom, and even Syriana. they needed a lot of scouts. They needed, a lot of production work. So we helped them out. So basically, we started out, and Red is basically a very, very convenient and very cheap tool for the industry to grow over here in the GCC. Basically, they're get to. I mean, what we do is we supply them with Reds. They get to learn what focus pulling is. It's pretty cheap. They get to learn a lot about the whole system of filmmaking rather than being guys who just shoot on video that does autofocus and auto exposing everything, you know. So it's a whole new learning curve to when it comes to filmmaking, and the Red provides that. And the Film Council basically gives these young filmmakers incentives to start bigger projects to get into feature filmmaking rather than just making short films. And the Red comes in handy. I mean, we're already ordering around 4 Reds. We are even going to be upgrading to an Epic when the Epic comes out. We're going to get like 6 Scarlets when they come out. And basically, we're expanding ourselves. We're getting professional Red trainers. We're thinking of getting during the Middle East National Film Festival, which is coming in October. And so we're getting all these guys and getting the whole industry here in the GCC to get acquainted with this whole this whole new digital filmmaking process.
Fantastic. So what's your role with it essentially? Are you shooting with it yourself?
Well, right now I shoot with it. I basically I'm usually there. I help them out with the technical stuff. I direct most of the time, but I do some DP work too. And but usually most of the time when I'm just doing my office job, I just rent it out to production companies for them, to take a spin and work in their commercials and stuff.
So what other gear did you get with the Reds?
With the Red, I got I got the production pack. I got all the nuts and bolts, everything that makes the Red more convenient to shoot with. Aside from the lenses, I still rent lenses. We've got plenty of lenses. Rental houses around here. So I rent out Cooks. I rent out Angies. I rent all sorts of lenses around here. And basically I'm working, I've got a bunch of Canon lenses, around 12 lenses to be precise. Sigma, Canon, from all over. And I'll be basically, I'm waiting out. I'm one of the first burger mount, reservation holders. I think I'm 55 or 56.
Okay, so you're doing a lot of the post in-house as well. What's the post workflow side of things for you?
I've got a Mac Pro, and I've also got a MacBook Pro too. So when I'm on set, I basically just take a quick look at them on my MacBook Pro and just hook up my CF card and take a look at it. If everything's all right, I just go ahead with a shoot. I shoot everything on my hard drive, and then basically I bring up my hard drive, download everything through FireWire 800, and put it on my hard drives on my Mac Pro, which is basically connected. I've got a RAID setup.
Yeah.
And two TVs. And what I do is basically I put it down, I edit it out entirely in FCP, and then I hook it up and export it into Crimson. I'd like to generate an XML file, get it into Crimson, and then out of Crimson again into RedCine, and then basically I export my entire video from RedCine. Edit it, of course, and then I just take the audio once again in FCP, take the new video, and basically generate the final edited version.
Okay, so is there much infrastructure out there as well for proper color grading?
Actually, yeah. If it's a paying gig, then it's different. Like if it's a commercial, we've got a lot of scratch studios. We've got flames and smokes all around. So when it's a paying gig, it's a totally different story. They've got it all figured out, so I just sit down with the guys and post, yeah. And they've got a lot of scratch systems, too.
Wow.
So, those are around, yeah.
It sounds like there is quite an infrastructure, just not a film-based one.
Yeah, not a film-based one. It's just an infrastructure for commercials.
With no sort of history of, essentially, of filmmaking, I guess, the look that, I guess, the Red is replicating film, this must be a real revolution, I suppose.
It is. Definitely it is, yeah.
Okay, so you've already mentioned that you'll be changing over at least one of the Reds to an Epic.
Definitely, yeah, definitely, in the long run.
What would be the advantage to you for an Epic?
I think Epic is still, not really clear, but I think what would be really beautiful, with what has been promised already, we can basically shoot on 5K and then down-res it to 4K, and since the compression rates will be about 100 megabits, which is way less compressed than what we have with Red One right now. We'll basically get a way better picture to work around and color correct in post. So that's a pretty neat thing we'd like to play with.
Can you touch on the film competition side of things, perhaps?
Basically, the Emirates Film Competition is a part of a bigger festival. It's called the Middle Eastern International Film Festival. Now, what the Middle Eastern International Film Festival is, it caters everyone. I mean, Tom, Dick, and Harry. Whereas the Emirates Film Competition, it caters to local filmmakers. I mean, it's more of a grassroots film competition or a film festival. So it caters them. So we provide them equipment, we provide them lighting gear. We're already purchasing a lot of stuff because, I mean, thanks to Red, we're getting a lot of stuff to buy, and they're already there. The authority also got the New York Film Academy. Yeah, I'm also a board member there. We've got the New York Film Academy to come and set up in Abu Dhabi, and they have three campuses right now, full time campuses. They give all the, everything. They have a campus in LA, they have a campus in New York, and they have their third campus, which gives full time all year round courses in Abu Dhabi. That's the third main branch right now. So, I mean, we're looking forward to a boosting film industry here in the Emirates especially.
Fantastic. So obviously, yeah. It's International Film Festival. You're getting a lot of entries and a lot of interest from around the world.
Yes, definitely. We're getting, from all over, yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, well, lastly, where can people find out more about yourself? How can they find you on Red User and about the Emirates Film Festival?
For the film festival, they can log on to the MEIFF, which are the initials of the Middle East International Film Festival. And they can also log on to reach me directly to the Emirates Film Competition website, which is efilmc.com.ae.
Fantastic. And on Red User, you are Akube, yeah?
Yeah, I'm Akube, Red User Akube, number 707.
Well, thank you, Abdallah, for talking to me today in the Red Room. I really appreciate it.
All right, thanks a lot. All right, buddy.
Cheers,
buddy. See you around.
Well, thanks for that, Abdallah. That was really great. Very interesting guy.
I love the fact that there's a global community. I'm a bit flat today, I must admit, because I've got a cold. So
well, I'm
sound
sort
a bit,
of the same, yeah, so apologies.
Different colds. But it's hard, yeah. I mean, if I'm perky, I'm going to start coughing and squeezing. But, we have had some amazing responses in people emailing us. I mean, just incredibly kind people.
Yeah, love it. It's you hear it all the time, podcasters sort of, before I sort of started doing this, you hear it all the time, podcasters saying, oh, look, yeah, I really wasn't sure what to expect, but let me tell you, I've got to keep going now because it's so good getting the feedback from people. And now I'm experiencing it firsthand. It's a really lovely thing.
Yeah, so it's so good.
Thank you for your very kind comments. Really appreciate it.
Definitely. We really appreciate it. And we're continuing our giveaway that we set up last week. This is running over a couple of weeks to give you the hydro clamp. And do you want to just again explain the rules of our competition?
Yep, it's pretty loose. Best five word phrase that describes the Monster Cine hydro clamp. So you can actually win this thing. It's really cool.
It's worth a few $100.
It's worth a bit. It's because it's a really good. I've seen them on a couple of machines now, and they work really well. But the trick is to go there and check out what it actually does, how it works, and just come up with a five-word phrase that describes how it works, or something stupid or silly, or
preferably something good. So you like the people at Monster City, that'd be something good. No, so email your answers to red@fxguide.com, and I want to thank Jim Clark for helping us out with that.
Yeah, thank you. And
also, I need to put a technical apology in for last week. We had a minor audio glitch that meant that the second half of the podcast, just for those that downloaded it in the first few hours that it was up, we managed to pull it, fix it, and put it back up. But I apologize about that. That was in class episode 9. So if you had an audio problem in episode 9...
Don't listen to 9.
Well,
is 9 still there and 9R is there? Or
okay,
they're
the
both,
new R.
Okay,
the new
right,
one.
Okay,
the new
fine.
One.
All right,
not the old one.
So if you did listen to it and you think we were a bit weird, that's correct. But go and find 9R anyway.
Excellent.
So, yes, apologies. Okay. So what's next for you, Mike?
Well, a lot, really. I'm doing stuff on FX PhD, so I'm preparing to go over to SIDGRAPH in a few weeks, but right now we're editing the stuff that we shot in Adelaide, which is really good, the stop-motion stuff, and we've just put up our O-Week video. That's our Orientation Week video, which is basically half an hour just running through all of the 30 courses we have on offer.
Massive. I don't know how you guys do it, honestly. That's not a suck-up. I just think it's amazing. When I know how much research I just have to do for this, how you guys do, you know, basically almost hundreds of the things.
Yeah, we try and just hit the highlights, obviously, but even at that pace, it still runs out to... So there'll be a shorter version, like a three-minute summary version we'll post probably next week, but there's a free download half-hour HD or high-res version of our O-Week video. Anyway, you can get that if you want to... interested in learning more about what we're up to. Over at fxphd.com.
Because there's footage from you in China and on the Great Wall.
That's fun,
behind
yes.
the Great Firewall of China.
Shot on the red. There's also stuff of us doing kung fu. I just loved having kung fu guys going off. And there's stuff from the Adelaide shoot, as well as you see a whole bunch of other things. There's just a huge, big red button in the middle of the homepage. Under July 08 terms announced, just click on that and it will download you the movie. And you can see all the stuff we've been talking about and what I've been up to and shooting.
And we'll put that in the show notes as well. Not that you need any...
Plus you get a shot at the FXPHD ski lodge.
Mike looking very Hugh Hefner.
Yeah, without the birds. And what about you, Jace?
Well, I'm going straight from here to start cutting these bloody... toddlers.
So hopefully next week you can give us a technical run through on your project.
Yeah, look, I'll know a little bit more about how the lenses all cut together and any sort of hiccups and how we went through. This is sort of, I suppose, the second or third job I've done with Red. So we've done a whole bunch more different things in workflow this time, which have made things extremely easier to get to the editing stage. So hopefully by the time I get to the other for the next episode, we'll be totally on the other side of that. And, I have a lot more to share about that because, it was quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, shot a lot of tests and stuff. And in terms of big projects, this is a good one. And, of course, we've been shooting tons of stuff and we've done the kung fu stuff we've done. And we're about to do another one, an interior-exterior thing, as part of our Red course this term, where we're going to be looking at lighting and sort of high-end production value things. But all of that and more next week when we team up again. Thank you so much for listening. As always, keep the comments coming and the info. And
Mike Seymour at Twitter and Wingrove on Twitter.
Yes.
JasonWingrove.com for
you,
me.
Have you got a Mac.com account yet?
.me.
.me. Sorry, beg your pardon.
I
said .mac, didn't I?
Yeah, throwscripts@me.com.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
throwscripts@me.com.
I think so. Something like that. I think there's probably a few better ones if I bother to think about it. Really? All the good funny ones will be gone pretty quickly. So if you've got a .mac account, every .mac email gets turned into a .me email as well. So talk dirty at me or something. I'm sure that one's gone.
Until next time, we'll see you later, guys.
See ya. See ya.
You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.